I've got some really good panelists with me, and I'd like to introduce them. We have Batenge. Batenge is from World Data Labs, and he's a familiar face. You'll recognize him. He was with the Permanent Secretary of the Ministry of Communication, Information and Technology here in Kenya. A lot of experience in the field. We have Zuleika. Zuleika joins us from SURE, she's got a lot of experience in the insurance and mass transit areas. And we've got Val from Microsoft. Val is very well qualified, and there's not much about data science that he does not know. And I would be interested to hear if anybody could catch you up. I doubt it. And lastly but not least is Njeri Wangari, who joins us from Geopol, the marketing manager there. Geopol is doing some really, really interesting stuff with big data. So, you know, given that big data is the subject of choice, the topic of the moment, some questions come to mind. You know, there's a lot of hype around it. Everybody's saying, oh, big data, cloud, analytics, all these things. So where is this actually going? And I think what I'd like to do is turn to you first, Val, and you know, could you just give us a sense of context? You know, what is big data? Is it just analytics? Is it just advanced storage? Could you just give us a sense of, you know, where is big data and where does it go from here?
Thanks very much for the question, Mark. So yes, there's been a lot of talk about big data, at least in the last 5 years. And true, there has been a lot of hype around it. But it's also fair to say that despite the hype, there's real reality in big data. The key thing about big data is that we now have the opportunity, frankly, to make smarter decisions based on all kinds of data, right? In fact, that's the one thing I want you to remember. When you think about all the talk about big data, small data, Hadoop, Drupal, whatever, data mining, the key is really about making better decisions based on the facts. Because in the past, we didn't have all the right information, right? Even for organizations who tried, typically they used to use mostly relational data that was stored in databases, right? And you used to analyze it using mostly business intelligence tools, right? But if that's all you do, unfortunately, you can't make the best decisions. Mm-hmm. For two reasons. Number one, if all you do is to make decisions based only on structured data, then you're missing the vast majority of data that's now available. Because analysts like IDC and Gartner and Forrester have shown that majority of data that we capture is actually unstructured. And by unstructured, I really mean non-relational data. Think about GPS data or called data that we collect on our phones, data from social media. That is now the vast majority of data we collect. So you can't rely only on structured relational data, right? One of the reasons for the excitement about big data is that in the last few years, we had a new wave of technologies that allow us to store all kinds of data cheaply, right? Because before, the only way to store, if you wanted to store web logs and, you know, the GPS data from cell phones, if you wanted to store it only in relational databases, it was expensive. And second, you hit the limits of a relational database because they were never designed for that kind of data. Relational databases were designed to store and manage relational data, basically structured data. And so now, with big data, we have this new element of non-SQL data stores, things like NoSQL and Hadoop environments that allow us to store petabytes of all of this unstructured data cheaply. So now we can analyze all of that data to get the facts. Then the second part is analytics that you mentioned, Mark. Instead of relying only on BI, today a good big data stack allows us to analyze all of that data using business intelligence or other advanced analytical approaches. For instance, now you hear a lot about machine learning, AI, for instance, real-time analytics. What this means is, put together, we now have a new solution stack in big data that allows us to make sense of all kinds of data we capture, which will give us new insights about our business and ultimately drive better decisions. But the one thing I want you to remember, despite all the hype, if any vendor tells you, hey, buy my big data platform because it's big, because you can store petabytes of data, that's not enough. The key thing, and what you should ask them is, what's in it for me? What do I get from this big data platform, right? If they can't show you how you can make smarter decisions from all of that data, then it's all a waste of time.
Excellent. Thanks for the great context there. You know, I think taking away from that is two key points, is that the world is now about big data is a reality, first of all. Mm-hmm. It's not just machine learning or big data warehouses, analytics and so on. But it's about multiple sources of data that you're integrating and mashing together to gain great new insights to make better decisions.
Yep.
And those decisions are also based on a vast multitude of tools now that one can use to really dig into data and go deep.
Correct.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's a great insight. And you know, I think you've given us a great segue here because I can lead straight to Zuleika. Zuleika is in a great business in insurance, right? And typically the thing in insurance is you have actuaries who figure out, you know, where how long you're going to live, what's your propensity to have an accident, what is the risk, and that's the big word is risk. What is the risk that you face in everything you do over your entire life? And based on that, the insurers decide, well, we can accept this amount of risk for this amount of premium and pay out accordingly. I think big data and analytics and the availability of the insights you must get nowadays must be absolutely phenomenal. Can you share with us some of your observations and the journey that you've been on here, Zuleika?
Yes, thank you for that, Mark. Here at Shaw Corporation, we are looking to make use of this data. As Val said, we are collecting data from everywhere and we've not been making sense out of it. We are collecting data from your cars, from your phones. We can be able to track your speeds, your location, but we're not using this data to make sense. So what we are doing at Shaw Corporation, we have built our own sensor-enabled device, which will essentially replace your insurance sticker, your current insurance sticker. That sensor-enabled device, the front-facing side is a QR code, meaning your information can be updated dynamically as you pay, and you can pay as you're using the car. You don't need to pay for insurance when you're not using the car, which is what we are doing right now. On top of that, the sensors we have sensors that check on your speed, on your location. They can be able to sense a lane change. They can be able to sense an accident. And with all this, we're able to really track you and do a hyper-personalized profile for you. This way, we're able to charge you according to your risk. Because currently you're charged, is it 4% or 7%, which is blanket for everyone. Whether you use it, you don't use it, you use it every day of the year, or you use it once a year, you have to pay. So now we can be able to really do what Safaricom did and do per minute, per day billing, or per monthly billing, and that will really change the insurance industry. We're also able to analyze a real accident. When we're able to analyze a real accident, we're able to now pay, we curb the fraud in the insurance industry. We're able to only pay what is a real accident. Because if you are over-speeding and you know you're over-speeding, then you should not be paid for that. The person you've hit is the one who's supposed to pay. Right now, everyone is compensated. That's where the insurance industry is tanking. But now with our platform, we are able to know who really deserves to be paid and be able to reduce the risk by over 30%. So we are really excited about what is coming, what we're going to bring forward in the insurance industry.
Amazing, some great innovations coming out there. It's a bit scary in some ways, you know. 11 o'clock at night when I'm leaving Jagunas, it's a whole different story. But thanks for that, Zuleika. Tenge, you know, I think you've got a wealth of experience, both from a government sector, public sector, and the private sector. And your latest venture is very much looking at entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the one thing that big data does with the insights it delivers, it shows where the gaps in the market are. And you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity that can possibly be realized. You want to share with us some of the insights? I know you've traveled recently and so on. share some of the insights that you've got around big data and the value of it.
Thank you. I wear several hats in big data. First, I am one of the advisors of the UN's Global Pulse. Global Pulse aggregates lots of big data from satellites and uses it in predictions on weather patterns and helps the farmers to understand what is happening. Here, they have been able to also work with several other people, like Stanford University, which is doing machine learning, and they link it with the data. For example, they have been able to decode almost 4,000 items, meaning that the satellite can now distinguish a human being from a dog or a cow. That's very important in the sense that in not too distant future, we can actually do a census on if you do an average of 1 month of people who wake up at 8 and walk outside, you can almost estimate the population. But the more important one is that using that data, because there are satellites which keep on going around every 30 minutes, you can see the changes in terms of if you see grass-thatched roofs, next you see tin-roofed, and then later you see tiled roofs, it actually tells you that either poverty is coming down there or poverty is increasing or it's remained the same. Now, I am also one of the founders of the Wild Data Lab. Wild Data Lab is to develop tools that would help countries to measure their progress towards achievement of the SDGs. I will give you an example, for example, measurement of poverty. We've been able to get to a point where how many people must you remove out of poverty every second in order to achieve the SDGs? So we use so many, the algorithm works around so many variables, and you are able to know that this country, you are reducing poverty at 100 people per second, and this will not take you to achieve the SDGs by 2030. And of course, we'll give you the variables that you need to impact in order to be able to achieve those variables. One other is where, if we know where you're born and where you live, we can be able to tell you what is it that you need to do if you are not driving as fast to live longer than the life expectancy around the people there. For example, we have taken into consideration if there is a prevalence of high diabetes in that area and you have diabetes, the algorithm has been able to calculate and it will tell you that ordinarily, diabetics have 1 year less than the life expectancy that has been worked out of this. But then it gets complicated if someone has diabetes, has HIV, then again you are able to see. But then it gives you the what is it that you need to do to mitigate against this. So more importantly is to help countries deal with the issues of SDGs much, much earlier than getting to 2030 and saying we did not achieve. Lastly, we've been working around agriculture, which I have great passion in. There's a database, I think some of you know, Grow Intelligence, which also gathers similar data from satellite. You are able to see the yield improvement, especially, for example, United States. What is it that they did that they harvest more maize per hectare than any country in the world? Actually, you can see the intervention when they put the law, intervention when they introduced new seed varieties, intervention when there was a scientific breakthrough. The only country in Africa that is very close to US is South Africa. But US is doing 11 tons per hectare, South African is doing 4. Yeah? Then you look at Kenya, the most of East Africans, we are doing less than 2, which is the rate at which US was doing after Second World War. It tells you that our policy was not informed by numbers. It's just that you plant maize and you go to church to give God a very hard work that God help us to harvest to harvest more than you could, actually. So we can reduce the headache to God by actually making certain interventions and they get the right harvest. I can go on and on, but let me allow others to...
Thank you for that.
Yes.
I think we all need to reduce the work we give God, that's for sure.
Yeah, even himself, he gets annoyed by the...
Exactly. I got to talking on that, you know, Butenge mentioned about, you know, being able to look at so many different sources of data and gain so many different insights. And again, what's impressive here is we're talking African examples, right? This is stuff that's happening right here in East Africa. And what I'd like to do is ask Njeri just to share with us. Njeri's with a company called Geopol, and she looks after, and she's an inveterate blogger as well. And she's done a lot of training in this area. And what I'd like to just see, you've got the ability through the data sources you interrogate and utilize, and most importantly, action, to make a big difference. Can you give us some examples of the type of insights that you've gotten, you know, in the last couple of months? Well, you know, there's been a lot happening in the world. There's the polls of Trump. There's things happening in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes.
Tell us some of the insights that you, and this is like real-time stuff, so it's speedy. Please go ahead.
Yes, and it's good that you mentioned real-time, because I think that's one of the things that makes us a very unique market research company, because for us, other market research companies are talking about turnaround period of about 6 months, we're talking about next day, that you can be able to send out a survey today and the next day you're able to get the results. So some of the interesting surveys that we have done in the last 6 months, I'd like to mention a survey that we did in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Yes, there was an expose that was done last year on the percentage of children who work in the mines and the extent of child labor. And it was a very big expose that was international. It appeared in all the major news outlets about the exploitation of children in the mines. But what was lacking is that voice from the individuals and those who actually work in the mines talking about this is what we see on a daily basis. So for us, following that report that was released, we ran a survey. We identified a particular district that has a very high, has very many mines. There's a lot of mining going on. And we ran the survey. We selected a sample of about 1,000 workers and we sent out SMSs to them. Now, let me just mention that the irony of this all is that everyone of us here has a cell phone, right? Do you know where most of the components of that phone come from?
DRC.
They come from the DRC. Mm-hmm. Now, the irony of this all is that we sent out the survey using mobile phones, mm-hmm. and we were able to get, in their own words, interactions with children, mothers and workers who have seen children work in the mines, the percentage of children who work in the mines, children who have been exposed to to dangers, how many have gotten injuries due to working in the mines, how long they work in the mines, and things like that. And this is data that we were able to collect by sending out surveys directly to the people, and we were able to do it within a very short time. And from that, we were able to get very good insights of how much does this go, what is the extent of this. When you talk about child labor in the mines, what exactly does it mean? How long do those children work in the mines? How young are they when they're working in the mines? So that is one of the surveys that we did in the DRC. Another very recent one is one that we did in Kenya. This was around the same around the time that we had a lot of insecurity in the public service vehicles. We call them matatus mm-hmm. here. And there had been incidents where a lady passenger was assaulted in a matatu, and there was also an incident within a span of 2 weeks where a lady motorist was almost dragged. And so what we wanted to find out is what is the prevalence of insecurity when using public service vehicles, specifically matatus, and to a large extent women. Yes, we wanted to know generally if people are harassed, either people are harassed in matatus, to what extent? Is it verbal harassment? Is it physical harassment? And also the percentage of women who have experienced either verbal harassment or physical assault in a matatu. And the insights were astounding. Over 55% of, actually, let me just go back a bit. A majority of Kenyans use public transport. Okay, so about 95% of Kenyans use public transport. And out of that 95%, 55% indicated that they had been harassed in a matatu. Wow. This is verbal harassment. Mm-hmm. And out of that number, the number of people who had witnessed women being harassed in a matatu, that number was at 50%. And we also went on to ask questions like, and to the women who took the survey, when this incident happened, did you report? And the other interesting thing that we noticed is that a lot of women do not report. Reason being, they had reported initially, nothing was done, and so they felt there's nothing that is going to change. And that was really telling, and it was quite scary, because the other thing that we noticed is that out of the women who had reported the cases, the farthest that it went is that it was recorded in the OB book, or rather the occurrence book. Very few of those cases went on to court or anything or any other action taken. And that gave us very good insights into how prevalent is this problem, and something needs to be done about it. And that is data that now we forwarded to the there's a body that deals with matatus, so that they can find ways actually, one of the things that we asked the respondents is how do you think this can be improved? I'd like to talk about the last survey that we ran, which is more on the commercial side as opposed to the ones that I've talked about, lean more on social, and it's because we have a lot of developers in the room. We ran a survey in six African countries, that's Nigeria, Uganda, Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, and Ghana. Have I mentioned Ghana? Yes, six countries in Africa. And this was in e-commerce. This was around just during the Black Friday sale, and we wanted to find out, there had been a lot of marketing by the known e-commerce sites in Africa, that's Jumia and Kilimall and quite a number of others. And we wanted to find out, has this Black Friday thing taken on? Is it a foreign concept that Africans don't really care for? Or is it taking on, and how has that affected e-commerce in Africa? Is African e-commerce still grappling with the same challenges that that it has always been facing, or has this interest by users on Black Friday and seeing it being replicated in Africa, has it somehow changed that? And one of the interesting things that we learned from the survey, we got 1,500 responses from the different countries that I've mentioned. And the interesting things that we learned is that In South Africa, the preferred mode of payment is credit card. Unlike all the other countries where we ran the survey, where they prefer cash on delivery. And that talked to us about trust. A lot of people who go online to buy things don't trust e-commerce sites. Mm-hmm. And that sort of underlines the major challenge that e-commerce sites have had in Africa, that trust is still a very big issue. And that's something that still needs ways of dealing with that. In terms of the other areas that they were happy with e-commerce sites is delivery, and I think that has a lot to do with the use of motorbikes, which we saw is cuts across the different countries, that we have the rise of what we call here border, and that has really shortened the delivery time in most places, where you order for something and you don't have to wait for 2 weeks or the next day for you to get it, you get it within the same day. So that just talks about being able to send out surveys on issues and things that are current affairs, mm-hmm. and being able to immediately get responses, not just from Kenyans here, but also in the other African countries where Geopol has a presence.
Thanks very much, Julian. That's really interesting. I'm in research myself, and I know that to do research in DRC, for instance, is really, really difficult. And the use of technology to do it, and then building that data set and gaining the insights it used for both social and economic benefits, and a very quick turnaround time is amazing. What I'd like to do now, we've been dominating the discussion
yes.
here, so the audience needs to also have a word, I'm sure. Can I ask the audience, please, join us with some questions?
Despite all the talk about big data, people, talk about petabytes of data, it used to be terabytes, and then, now you need petabytes. We can do better. We can do exabytes of data. The truth is this, you don't need petabytes of data to get insights that will help you make smarter decisions. You can get a lot of good insights from small data. In fact, a good case in point is my colleague, Njeri, right? She's just given three solid examples of cases where they found new information. I mean, things they didn't know about, right? In very, very different contexts, just based on surveys, right? A survey of 1,500 people will not give you terabytes of data, but it can give you very, very powerful information you didn't have before.
Let me disagree a little bit. the advent of big data mm-hmm. is to move away from sampling and incorporate both unstructured data into structured data.
Correct.
So that you see more visibility. Mm-hmm. I'll give an example for the Matatu harassment. It is very difficult to define harassment in this part of the world. Actually, even when I saw Trump defending himself, it was very difficult to define harassment. If you brought in unstructured data into high results, it would be different completely. And that's why the word big, it means that you are very close to the population. If you say mobile users, if you got the mobile data set, there are 30 million registered. If you get the entire CDR data, you are actually very close to the population, and that should give you a very precise answer. If you take a sample mm-hmm. of that, you probably find it different because of variability in terms of others who come from this region have a different view of that. A good example is a recent study on health in this country. So many studies by sampling people to study why so many people are dying out of cancer. There was no visibility. So recently, Oxford, Cambridge did almost the entire health data. I think some of you saw it. And now they have gone to a level where the type of cancer you get is related to where you're coming from. That's actually one step closer to knowing what is causing it, because now you begin to ask, why would more people from this region have more of esophageal cancer than the other ones? So that is the role of big data. If we say we do sampling and then we get it, then we are coming out of the word big. In fact, most people, if you ask people secretly, they say, ask me any question, they would ask, why is that big in front of data? And yes. That is the very reason why we have big, big data. And you could use various, incorporate different other data to see visibility that you can't see from a sample.
The key point I was making earlier is that sometimes we feel like we have to wait till we collect data on the whole population to make analysis. Then the second thing is, you know, you have to start from somewhere. You have to be very practical, right? So, which is why I suggest whatever data you have, start with it. You will learn, and then you know, by necessity, you can add as necessary. Then the second thing is one of cost. You know, when you're dealing with unstructured data, the volume adds up very, very quickly, especially if you're using things like images, video files, satellite images. The volume increases exponentially. Luckily, with platforms, unstructured platforms like Hadoop now, the cost doesn't grow exponentially as well. But still, your cost will increase, right, as you add more and more nodes to your Hadoop cluster. And one of the key things I really like about statistics, in fact, I really believe one of the magic of statistics is this thing called sampling. Because done correctly, because there are many ways to screw up sampling, but if you do sampling correctly, you can draw, if you draw a representative sample of the population, so with that, with a survey of 1,500 customers, as long as you sample correctly, you can start to make inferences on the whole population that are actually true. But the key thing is, you have to sample correctly.
Absolutely. Just one last thing. Big data is almost, in all cases, collected passively. And that's very important in Africa. If you seek, stop outside there and ask women, how many children do you have? 80% will lie. But if you give them the forms to fill in where their school, the kids go to school, you actually get 100% correct.
Selection bias.
But the question around big data is, the data itself isn't really a massive part of what big data is, and I think, Batenga, you started to talk about that. Is it not specifically more about the analytics and the intelligence that comes out of it rather than the data set that's being analyzed?
He's right. It's not really, because if we get lost in the semantics of how big is the data, we sort of lose sight of the potential. So it's about what insights can you be able to get from that data, and that sort of circles back to what you were talking about. Do you have the computing power? Do you have the time to work with big data so that you can be able to draw the same analytics that probably you would have if you had sampled? So it's a question of how to get there. Take the shortest route or take the longest route, but get there. But the most important thing is getting there. Mm-hmm. So being able to get to get analytics from the data is what is most important. So because sometimes we get hung up on the big data part of big data.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
I think you know that this is the ongoing problem. Is and I think Val, your references is not about the petabytes. It's about the insights.
Yes. Yeah, it's ultimately about the insights.
That's what you want at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's true that the more sources of data you can analyze, then the more insights you'll draw, right? But as Jerry is correct that it's a trade-off, because it costs more and it takes more time to analyze more sources of data, right? But one of the reasons where there's so much excitement about big data is that now we have the tools to store and analyze these new sources of unstructured data in ways that were not possible before, right? The fact that you can go mine terabytes of web log files, right, without breaking the bank, or the fact that you can now deploy, say, especially using cloud-based machine learning tools like from Cortana Intelligence, you can now quickly analyze satellite images, right? That is insightful, but ultimately, you need to analyze that data correctly. Otherwise, you can't get the insights. And as I said earlier, the whole point of big data is to really glean new insights that helps us make smarter decisions. Without that, we're just wasting money.
The on social data, I still say, especially in Africa, you need a lot of unstructured data to understand. If we were to use results to make policy, the policy would be useless. But if we went back to talk to those boys in the matatus and ask them, where were you born and stuff like this, how were you brought up? When boys are brought up in Africa, almost always from when you are a little thing, you have no respect for women. And so the policy here would be, don't harass, when actually you need to deal with cultural change. Sure. Let us agree that on big data, actually you need multiple sources of data. Absolutely. To be able to get the correct decision, especially policy.
I think that's very, very valuable.
Yeah. So if I could just step in on that, I think Dr. Bitange has put it correctly. It's all about the application of the analytics. Is it to make business decision? Is it to inform policy?
Exactly.
Because if it is to inform policy, then our research would not have been sufficient alone. Mm. It would have been one of the pillars that, yes, we have identified there's a problem. This is how the extent that it goes. But there are the things that need to be, there's an information that needs to be collected before a policy can be built on that. But if it is to make a business decision, then it's all about racing against time, because you are probably trying to seek leverage with your competition. So your competition is not going to give you 6 months for you to analyze your data and decide the next move that you're going to make. So it's the trade-off that you have to make. So it depends really on the application.
I think that's very valid. You know, it's very much about what asking the right question in the right circumstance. There was a gentleman at the back. If you just wanted to, I think this will be our last question because we're going to run out of time.
So, thank you very much. I'll be very very short. My name is Stefan. I run a mobile and web real-time transport information platform here in Kenya. So most of the information is actually user-generated. There was one element that hasn't been really addressed in the discussion, although it was very exciting. It's the issue of privacy. So in an information age, digitized age, where we have so many different access points to data, my particular question, and any of you can actually answer it, is how do you balance big data with concerns around privacy?
We actually spent 2 days in Cape Town 2 weeks ago, the first UN Global Big Data Conference, discussing around that issue. And the consensus was like, some of the data we can't afford to talk about privacy. The understanding is that the civil society must also understand that this data would help us find things that we never knew, especially in health, that somehow we must strike a balance in providing this data for analytics to create new products that will be more useful to us than keeping it to rot and we are dying. So there is still, the assumption is that even the data you get is anonymized. But of course, people find ways of manipulating and getting to know. But always the people who ask for privacy, they are never worried how much Google knows about them.
This is true.
Yeah. With our platform, I think the issue with privacy is neither here nor there, because as he's saying, you can, if someone wants to know where I am, they can know just from my phone, because I carry my phone everywhere. Even on Facebook, you have all these location sensors that you leave them on, and someone can be able to track you. But I think when it comes to how you position what you're selling to the consumer, you need to let them know how it's going to benefit them. If you tell me it's going to benefit me for you to know where I am, either it's to know, to be able to keep me safe, or to be able to maybe direct me to a deal if I'm in a mall, or to be able to tell me there's traffic on a certain road, don't go now, or use this other route, you're giving me back time. I need to be able to see the benefit of me giving you my personal information. If you position it that way, then I don't think someone will find an issue giving up certain informations about themselves.
Well, there's a rider. You must disclose to the client. Somebody like me who doesn't want to know where my wife is, I wouldn't register.
Yes.
For that.
Yeah, just, yeah.
No, but it's actually a very profound question, and Mark is right. I mean, you could spend, practitioners have spent weeks, right, in conference debating this issue, because the truth is that big data comes with a lot of power, but with great power comes great responsibility. There is, as we apply these new technologies, we have to be careful of the ethical consequences, right? I mean, this thing has real impact if misused. So Zuleika is right that I think the most successful applications and big data products will be the ones that generate true value to your customers, right? When people see value, they can share more. But if you make them, if you try to exploit them for your own personal gain without providing any value, it's just wrong. They'll push back. Ultimately, I think the more healthy applications of big data will be the ones that A, generate value, but B, also seek consent from the user, right? More and more now, you're seeing even on social media that vendors are actually giving you the choice to opt out, right? So, if you're using some location-based application today, the responsible vendor will say, okay, I'm about to log your location. Is that okay? Do you want to share your location? And if you don't want to, you can turn it off. That just means you won't get location-based targeted ads. But let me just round up, let me just close with this one fascinating personal experience. And it's with social media, especially Facebook and Instagram. Personally, I found it really intriguing how we have changed our position on privacy when we interact with Facebook or similar sites, Instagram, right? 15 years ago, people would be very uncomfortable if you asked them to share photos of their family or photos of their children, right? It was a no-go area. But today, once we opt in and start using Facebook and Instagram, I'm amazed how much people share with me. They'll not only share photos of their wives and children, but now they check in. Oh, I just checked into Radisson Blue in Nairobi. And next, I just checked into a carnivore restaurant. Thanks very much, but do I really need to know that? But it's all done. The only reason I don't worry too much about it is that they have chosen to share that information, right? So it's an opt-in process.
Mark, if I may mention something, and I think just to throw a spanner in the works, is that we haven't even talked about metadata. And I think it's going to be the biggest thing going forward in terms of big data. Things that we are saying about ourselves without necessarily saying it. And that has already become a big challenge because there was an instance in the US where Black Lives Matter activists were blocked based on their metadata, that the companies that were able to know where they were, the locations where they were, based on their metadata, not by getting onto Facebook, getting onto Twitter, and just, you know, having enabled settings of show location and things like that. And it was based on that metadata that the companies were able to identify them. So going forward, as we talk about big data, let's also think about, as we talk also about privacy, the impact that, you know, incorporating metadata into that, how that is going to affect us, especially when it comes to privacy.
I think we're out of time. I've been told I should end the session. By old-fashioned means that it wasn't big data that told me this. But thank you very much for your attention. I think, you know, the question of privacy and security is something that bears an additional track, maybe.
Absolutely.
For Microsoft, I think, is something you might
want to pick up. Absolutely. Good feedback.
In summary, I think, big data is a reality. It's a reality here in Kenya, in East Africa, and across the continent. I think there's opportunities for innovation, entrepreneurship that arise very, very strongly out of this. I think there's the real-time angle of this and the quality of the data enables really strong, quick decision-making. I think the future here is going to be about teamwork, working as a team. Big data is not an individual exercise. And I'd just like to, on that note, thank you all very, very much for attending and for participating so freely and contributing to the discussion, and also to the audience. Thank you very much.